Hello and welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and my guest today is Michael Gay, someone that you may not be familiar with, someone that you may not know or have even heard of. And how wonderful is that? Because this dude is brilliant and wise and deep and powerful. He is a therapist. He was formerly based in Boulder, Colorado. He has a master's in clinical mental health counseling from Naropa University. He studied also transpersonal psychology. Additionally, he spent 6 years working as a wilderness therapy guide, taking teens, adults, and families out into the mountains and the high deserts to live off the land and have epiphanies and insights and support. He's a good dude. He's profound and eloquent. And in this conversation, we dive deep into the idea of contact, what it means to be powerful, and the definition that he offers and that we dissect will surprise you. It is unique and I think powerful. What else do we talk about? We talk about butterfly wisdom, talk about horses, talk about relationships, get a little bit deep towards the end and talk about universal consciousness, you know, all the standard light topics that that you know and love. He's a good dude. I met Michael in October in person. I went to an event that Trevor Boehm led for men, where I lived in a house with 22 dudes for about 4 days and had a very radical personal experience with the powerful phenomenon that is men's work. So if you are a man, if you know a man that is looking for an adventure, they have a few coming up in 2022, and I will likely be popping into one of them, but to be determined. Anyway, Michael's brilliant. I adore him. He's a true, like, old soul, salt of the earth kind of dude, and his perspectives and his wisdom are wide-reaching and challenging in the best way possible. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Michael Gay. This episode is brought to you by Cured Nutrition. Cured is the leader in CBD supplementation with an entire line of products designed to take your everyday life to its ultimate potential. Their daily staples are formulated with an in-house clinical herbalist, which has taken the traditional CBD regimen to an entirely new level of optimization. If you're anything like me, you like waking up feeling good and living well. You've probably toyed around with the idea of finding healthy alternatives to jumpstart your morning. Personally, it's why I start my day with Cured Rise, which is their focus supplement. It's a powerhouse blend of functional mushrooms like lion's mane and cordyceps, broad spectrum CBD, and powerful adaptogens. It gives me clean, clear, and sustained energy without any of the caffeine jitters or crash that I get with coffee. After I get going, Aura is next. It's another blend of functional mushrooms, CBD, and adaptogens, but it's got a twist. We all know how important it is to sustain our immunity nowadays, and this covers all of my bases. The vitamin D, prebiotics, crucial antioxidants are delivered straight to the gut, which is the foundation of our emotional and physical health. Am I right? Second brain. It's where the majority of our serotonin production and immune function begin, or it keeps everything in check, performing at its best, so I have one less thing to worry about, and I obviously cannot forget Zen. I use it every night. It is certainly why it has become Cure's number one selling relaxation and sleep product. You know the long nights spent tossing and turning? Yeah, not with this stuff. It has ingredients like reishi mushroom, ashwagandha, magnesium, passion flower, broad spectrum CBD, so thankfully, restlessness is something of the past. Cured Nutrition products are your answer for a daily dose of health. Visit curednutrition.com. That's C-U-R-E-D nutrition.com. Be sure to use the coupon code LOVEBOMBS, and at the checkout, you will save 10% off your order.
Push that button. All right, man, we're good. So as usually happens, we're jamming on something before we record. It's like, we should probably just start. But what were you going to offer in response to my idea about generational trauma as it manifests in cycles that could be tracked through history.
I think that the cultures that really do well have a living wisdom. Like they've observed the patterns for long enough and they kind of know how they flow, and they have a body of wisdom in the culture to help people adapt more gracefully and skillfully and wisely to those natural turning cycles. And so how it relates in my world is there's this concept of initiation. And what is that? Like that's plugging people in to a certain larger matrix in life with an awareness of these cycles. And can we create humans who navigate those cycles better? If we don't, then we just swim in this unconscious flow of archetypal force. And there are people and cultures that have kind of figured a way to buoy themselves from being churned in the waves, to like sail on it rather than being tossed by the ocean. So what are the wisdom traditions or the ways that we can make humans into people who navigate those cycles better? Can they hold these bigger pictures? Can they be aware of those flows of energy in themselves, in the collective? And can they respond? So initiation to me is like getting a human to have the capacity to navigate them, to be aware of them, to feel them, and to kind of creatively adapt so that we keep the best parts of ourselves and humanity alive through these strange turnings of energy. And it always has to be evolving. Like there's always forces of time, of chaos or entropy or just change that will cause certain solid, like, you know, a genius is born and a genius dies. Like you have to always be reinventing a wisdom. And I feel like we've lost the art of how to make it living. You know, we study like this great thinker or this great poet. There's not a real lineage of a living wisdom. Like how does it, it's going to look different in the next generation, but how do we wake it up? Especially now, there's things are changing so quickly. A big book at the beginning of my journey was this, when I was like 18, this book called Contemplation in a World of Action by Thomas Merton. And he was a Catholic monk who was looking at how quickly culture and society was changing. So this monastic tradition that had existed for hundreds of years was used to the person that came in being kind of the same, because evolution was fairly slow, but culturally, technologically, everything is sped up. So each new generation that comes in is so different. And these old wisdom traditions don't quite know how to adapt to such a different baseline consciousness of people that are coming in. So he was holding that question, like, how do we adapt to this rapidly changing world? Like this is an initiatory conundrum that we've never been in before. Like society has never evolved this fast, this quick. Our traditions, wisdom traditions, baseline knowledge doesn't know how to preserve this kind of wisdom through this rapid change. Like it's like a rapid ice age. Like, wow, like the landscape changes so quickly. Like in just a generation, the land goes from tropical to ice. Like we've lived here for metaphorically thousands of years in the tropics. We have no idea how to do it on the ice. But can you instill in people the creativity, the ingenuity, the intuition to discover the new ways of adapting to the evolving landscape?
Man, I love that. It's so crazy. Like, it's such a silly thing to say. Like, the world is crazy. But what came up for me there was like elephants. I was thinking about elephants. Like, elephants are long gestation periods, and they live for a long time, and they're slow moving. It's like, and they're hanging out, and they're social. And you have these like fruit flies, which they conduct experiments on because their genetics are changing so quickly, and they're just rapidly turning over and turning over. Yeah. And we're kind of transitioning from this slower, collective, egalitarian humanity that once was, and we're on this kind of exponential rising curve that, as you say, is changing faster and faster and faster. And we're trying to keep pace with that using outdated or ineffective tools or ways of being or culturally connecting, etc.
I relate it to, if it's okay to reference that piece from earlier, like this is a nomadic time in a way. Like people that have been pastoral are all of a sudden forced to become nomadic.
Hmm. Do you mean specifically in the pandemic and remote working, or do you mean broader scale?
It's a total metaphor. Like if you think of the structures and traditions, spiritual traditions, like we've been historically so local in our views, in our communities, that's like having a very local lifestyle. Like my family for generations has known this same forest and we've hunted it. We know the rhythms of it metaphorically. But right now things are changing so quick. The landscape is changing under us and we're kind of like rootless. And so the wisdom has to kind of pick up and not be rooted just in location. It has to be inside of us. We have to be like walking embodiments of the wisdom. Like all the things we might know in one forest have to walk with us as we are across the changing landscape. If I'm making sense, like the knowledge has to fully live inside. It's like a little spore, like floating through space time, you know?
Man, I love you. You're great. that got me thinking about this idea of nervous system regulation and dysregulation and how we have to find our center. And you hear a lot about these ideas of returning home to yourself or finding the truth within and maintaining that as a core part of your existence. But it seems like you're taking it even a step broader, more far-reaching, which is to say, no, the ancestral wisdom and ways of which you are a part need to also adapt and be carried onward wherever you go. Do I hear that right?
Yeah, I guess I'm saying we're in a weird situation because the ancestral wisdoms that may have helped people culturally are not as applicable now, like because of how quickly technology changes our culture and society. But it's our job to like tap an inner source of ingenuity and wisdom to respond. It has to be an inner source because we can't rely on the structures to prop us up as much.
Is it fair to say that what is occurring is a initiation of some kind? It's a consequence of that?
When the pandemic kind of got going, mythologist and storyteller Martin Shaw, among others, talked a lot about this time as an initiation. Like we're going into like a trial of sorts. This is strange, unfamiliar territory. Reality doesn't work in stable, clear, linear ways or logical ways anymore. And with all initiations, you might fail. Like that happens. Like sometimes it's not successful. And so we're definitely in an initiatory age. Like there's not clear ground under us. And we have to find a place inside that allows us to respond.
Hmm. And it's slippery too, right? I heard Francis Weller talking about initiation versus trauma and how initiation is a controlled or contained encounter with death, whereas trauma is an uncontained encounter with death. And it seems like right now, that's a pretty gray area that we're operating in, whereby we don't necessarily have the elders in the community to guide us collectively through this initiation.
Totally.
We talk about leadership and transparency and trust, et cetera, uh-huh. at a big scale. I feel like that initiation versus trauma component is bouncing a little bit back and forth. And I think we all feel that, sort of the ground out from under our feet.
Francis knows a lot more than me, and I'm familiar with there certainly being initiations that are not that contained. Like the real risk of like death and annihilation literally and metaphorically exist, and they have to, because we have to see how we do with those forces. And that's just part of it, is swimming in the chaos.
How's your swimming practice going? How's your training? How do you manage this as somebody that has a broad perspective historically, culturally, that you seem like quite a grounded dude who's used to being out in nature and the unexpected, unexplored terrains?
I think that's the piece, man. Like my swimming is, I'll tell you, the symbols really help me, like organize energy. Symbols are like maps. if I think about what our time is like right now, I think about monarch butterflies. Like, here, just stay with me. So it hit me that monarch butterflies, they don't live that long. You know, they start at their place in Mexico, and then they migrate up through the states, and they're going towards Canada. And, you know, one generation of butterfly will go a third of the way. They go through the whole life-death cycle, lay new eggs, like new ones are born. Another generation goes the next third of the way. You know, I may get the details wrong on how many quadrants there are, but it's several life cycles of butterfly to make it to Canada. And then this whole other generation is born called super butterflies that flies all the way from Canada back to Mexico in one shot. Like, they live the whole way. And it hit me so hard that there's not a tangible butterfly that flew that path with them another time. Like, if you think about salmon migrating, birds migrating, there's older birds that flew this path before us. And maybe once or twice, I got to kind of tune my compass to theirs. They know the path. But with butterflies, every generation like dies so quick. So the whole new generation, no one knows where the fuck to go. No one knows. The whole new generation's born. They wake up somewhere in Texas and they're like, Canada's that way. And, you know, we're going to be on the same milkweed plants all the way. There's this intelligence in life that's so hard to understand that comes from a place inside that, and humans do interesting things. We really rely on external sources of wisdom, like our friends, our family, our teachers, our spiritual traditions, our great literature and art, to kind of like help us find the way. But right now, I'm not saying we should leave that. I wish we would dive all into those great leaders that we still have access to. But I do think the times are asking us to have kind of like a butterfly wisdom that we have to find the path, even though no one has walked it before us. Like, we have to know where we're going. And so it's a very inward journey. So my swimming is like, what the heck can I do in my life that connects me to this like inner knowing that tunes my compass so that I can like keep flying on a good path.
And what does that look like practically for you to,
sure,
as you attempt to cultivate butterfly wisdom?
Sure. I've never used that word before. It's fun for it.
I like it, man. I'm into it.
Yeah. It's an attunement to this place inside. So in that place dictates where and what I do. It's like, read this book now, go and walk in the moonlight, connect with this person. Listen to this music for a while. Let yourself be taken for a wave. Like, get really obsessed with this part of music from this part of the world. Or that's what it is for me. And I don't know what the heck it's doing to me. Like, that I've been obsessed with, you know, tambour music for the last couple of years. Like, I have no idea, but it's doing something. It's like putting something in my bones and my cells and my consciousness that I don't understand. Like, I'm taking in, I think of it like an animal that wakes up in the spring and they just know what to eat. Like, yeah, the larva is born and it just knows what plants are food. And I'm just like finding what's food to me. So it's like, it's a very primal, like, what are the things that nourish me and make me grow? We have to have that instinct. So it's, again, we're metaphorical territory here, but practically what it looks like are the people that I surround myself, the places that I surround myself with, the amount of time I try to spend unplugged from things that are not that nourishing, from like kind of, there's a lot of collective momentum going in some non-nourishing ways. So I have to be,
I think that's an understatement, Michael.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, I've described that as heart whispers, like intuitive pulls, these little heart whispers. They're just like, psst, hey, this music's cool. Get obsessed with this. And you're like, and then the brain, I describe as like fear starts shouting. Like, that doesn't make any sense. I'm like from the Midwest. I live in Hawaii. I can't be doing that. Like, what will my family think? Or that's stupid and blah, blah, blah. But it sounds like you've cultivated a healthy relationship with that intuitive inner guidance system, and that you perhaps have more trust in that or more faith in that.
Yeah, most. That's really, really well said. And it's not without mistakes. Like, just like anything, learning to ride that inner guidance system, there's a learning curve. And so I would say I got wrecked a lot in my life. Like I got wrecked worse from following that internal guidance system than I did otherwise. That was like the price paid for learning to ride that bicycle.
What's an example that you feel like sharing or that comes
sure.
to mind?
I got really ungrounded going to India and trying to practice really intense forms of meditation for long periods of time. Like my mind and my modern consciousness was not prepared for that kind of practice with that kind of intensity. I got really ungrounded and catalyzed some things in my life that I'm sad about and were really heartbreaking for me and other people. And like literally just kind of scrambled my being. And I felt really disoriented for years. It's very hard to describe. Like when you start trying to follow things on that level that are very deep, you can also mess it up. And it takes a long time to rebuild. But yeah, I got really just ungrounded. Like a lot of energy flowing in my body. Like my mind wasn't as stable. My heart was all over the place. Like it was very hard for me to feel a sense of identity like I used to. It was a strange thing, but it was like a dissolving of like a personality structure in ways that felt horrible. But I've gotten to piece myself back together. So that I had to learn a lot. Like, wow, like you're messing with really big forces by trying to like learn this stuff. Like you can mess yourself up. You could die. You could go little bananas, but I just have this instinct that I have to learn. It's like being really drawn to the ocean. Like, yeah, it's dangerous. Like you can die out there if you don't know how to sail and you just like try to jump out there and surf on these instinctive waters. My compass isn't that tuned. Like I haven't lived around people that follow this inner guidance very well. And so I'm rusty. I'm overcoming like generations of separation from this inner knowing place.
Was it that you followed the inner guidance or that you mistook ego for inner guidance?
That's exactly what happened. But like, it's hard to know the
difference. At the time, you were just like, yeah, it's inner guidance.
Yeah, it's what it feels like. So that was the learning curve of finding the difference between the inner voice and ego. Yeah. That inevitably is a meeting place. You nailed it.
How do you do that? Because I get asked, I'm sure you get this question a lot too, which is like, how do you distinguish between intuition and fear or desire and social pressure, etc.? Like, what does it mean to you to, if you had to describe that inner guidance or to cultivate it or to hone it, like, how do you describe what that is?
There's a movie that I just watched, like a Persian film about dervishes in this pilgrimage called Baba Aziz. And the opening line of the movie is, there are as many paths to God as there are souls on the planet. There are as many paths to God as there are souls on the planet. And so if I'm going to tell you what it feels like this is sort of like the guru danger. Is you have someone who's really wise, who knows a lot more than you, but your job isn't to like imitate them or follow them. You know, it's that same old adage, like seek what they sought. And so I think even in the Grail legends, like Joseph Campbell talks about this all the time, in the quest for the Grail, each of the knights that set out on the journey, the text says they entered the forest, each at a place of their choosing, where it was darkest. They thought it would be a tragedy to go out together. So you literally have to enter this forest alone at a place that's kind of dark. So that gives you a sense. Like you probably shouldn't be doing it fully with other people or following someone. You really have to know what it's like to navigate the woods metaphorically on your own. So to give up that impulse or compulsion to like, either through camaraderie or through like outsourcing some of your own knowing to other people, you really have to navigate it inside alone. And it's going to be kind of dark. So I can just say that. All we can do is kind of point at it a little bit. I don't want to give too many instructions. There are certain paths in this life that are purely energetic. And the only ways we have of talking about them are in metaphor. And it doesn't lend itself, thank God, to podcasts or linear books or, you know, a flowchart of the map of spiritual awakening.
Which is so annoying. The scientist in me is like, I want the bullet point summary synopsis of wisdom acquisition and enlightenment training and approximate timeline, budget, right? One quote that I've heard, and I can't remember who said it or how it went, but the takeaway was something like, I knew it was my path because there wasn't one in front of me. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was no longer on the beaten trail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't know where to step.
Ooh, I love that.
That's how I knew that this is my path, like my journey, so to speak. Reminded me of that description of the knights kind of stepping into the darkness. It's like, it's scary. There's that unknown. Mm-hmm. And I think it requires this inner courage or this inner faith, so to speak, that butterfly wisdom again. It's like, I don't know why, but here's where I'm supposed to enter the forest, and I'm supposed to enter the forest, and here we go.
Yeah.
Right. But you just touched on energetics, and I know that is a passion of yours, an interest. And when we spoke the other day, you mentioned that is something that you wanted to discuss.
Yeah, you bet.
So, I mean, where do we dive into that? Because that in itself is one of those topics that could be, maybe that's the metaphor again. It's like in the energetic forest, how do we begin? Like, what's the first step do you reckon?
Totally. So I'm not sure if your podcast folks are going to see what's behind me if they're just listening, but I have this tapestry of the cave paintings at Chauvet of horses. And these are roughly 30,000-year-old paintings. And honestly, it was a mentor, like my primary mentor, Dewey Freeman, who got me connected more to the horse world. I'm still very, very, very young and new there. But it was a reckoning. It was to be around horses more. I needed something to be a mirror that helped me feel how much of life is purely energetic. It's not conceptual. It's not words. It's not thoughts. It's not ideas. So much of life to me, if not almost all of it, is just energy and an energetic experience. And we are also, as humans, extremely energetic beings. Horses, I mean, I guess the way we would think of it in our mind is horses, you know, they're not going to speak to us with words. But so much happens between us when we're out there working together, that it's been a little bit like a practice that helps peel back the layers, and I've still got really a long ways to go. It just was a giant reflection of like, you need to see and feel how much of your life, your relationships, everything about you is an energetic experience. I'm so used to living in my head onto this default mode network, on this concepts of reality. And the more I inhabit my concepts, the less I've become an energetic being. Like my concepts might reflect energetic patterns that I love and am allied with, but I'm still separate. That's a big part of Gestalt, which is my background, is like, you don't talk about things. You speak from things. You embody. It's a shift in a way of being. And it's a real effort in the psychological sphere to push things back towards being and energy and expression and aliveness, vitality. Fritz Perls said, lose your mind and come to your senses. So your senses are a great way to come in. All of the senses, movement, dance, art, song, and anything that gets your full being engaged without words. I don't want to demonize words. I'm just saying we're a little like word concept heavy. So we might do well to like really develop a culture of energetic practices that were more wordless and less intellectual, and everyone, again, will have their own entry point. But that's the big piece for me is energetics. Like, as a, in my world, I'm a therapist. So working with couples or with people in general, how much of what's happening between two people is purely about the energy? And they stay stuck because the energy is stuck, not because they can use all the right words. They can do NBC, they can do all kinds of stuff, but their energy isn't making contact. And so horses for me were kind of what blew it off to a whole other level. I'd had a lot of things from earlier in my life, spent a lot of time outside in the wild alone with groups, but it's what burst the bubble in my mental self to like surrender. Hey, you don't need to spend so much time up here. Start becoming an energetic being much more than anything else, because that's what you are.
Can you expand on that a little bit, perhaps with that idea of contact, but also for those listening that aren't aware of what equine therapy is and the use of horses in a therapeutic setting?
Yeah.
You mind saying a bit about that?
Sure. So a little piece about horses, and what was the other part?
Contact.
Sure. So in equine therapy work, there's a lot of different ways that people do it. Practically speaking, for people that don't know, it might be something like grooming or leading a horse around or riding or just standing near. But the school that I'm from, it's different. Like it has a Dewey and his mentor, Mark Rashid. There's, in Dewey's background in Gestalt, it's all about contact. It's all about an energetic experience between two beings, be they people or people on a horse or a herd of horses. So as a facilitator, you kind of lead people into this energetic zone a little bit through your own energy, and then you take them out with a horse or in a herd. And it might be something simple, like just make contact with the horse, and you intentionally leave it nebulous. But you get to see what people's idea is. Of that is. Is it going up and petting them? Is it looking at them? Is it following them around? Is it, you know, can they read the horse's body language? Can they feel them? Can they feel themselves? Dewey talks a lot about horses being bullshit detectors, and they really care a lot about congruence. So like, does your inside energy match your outside energy? Are you secretly like really angry inside, but you're presenting as happy and relaxed? Like you're scared of the horse or you're upset about something else. And horses don't like that. They want you to just be congruent, your inside to match your outside. And you can be really angry and losing your marbles in a horse pen. And if you're just congruent, then they're kind of relaxed and groovy often with that. But if you come in with incongruent energy, they're going to walk away. They might bite you. They might just walk, you know, leave. It doesn't feel good to be around someone who's incongruent. And so that's pretty wild. Like, how does a horse know that I'm incongruent? It's not through facial cues or whatever, like it's a feeling. There's an energy that comes from my body into their body, and they're experiencing me on a very deep level, energetically, perhaps much more than I realize. And they might be really good teachers for me to reattune to how much is in it. Can I feel them? Can I feel myself? So it's really great, because when you start working with horses, all the stuff that we use to deflect or hide from ourselves or the ego stuff disappears. Like, you can't fake your energy. I mean, you kind of can with humans, but not with horses.
Yeah, I remember Dewey saying or telling that story. So for those listening, I was at an event in Denver, just outside Denver, with Michael and Dewey Freeman and Trevor Boehm. It's a men's weekend. If you're listening, you should go. It's magical. And him saying, oh, the horses, like if you're angry and you're showing it, then that's okay. The horses are pretty mellow with that. Like, they get it. But if you're feeling really angry inside and you're trying to be calm, then it's upsetting to them. And I started thinking about my own life, of course, because I'm selfish and that's what we do as humans. And it's like, oh, this makes sense in my relationship when my partner, who I joke is a heart antenna, is like, what's going on? And I'm like, no, I'm fine. It's all good. Everything's fine. She's like, ah, I, or or my favorite, least favorite line of, I can't feel you right now.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm sure you as a therapist have heard these stories countless times.
I have, and I've had them said to me also.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, dang. So I was being incongruent subconsciously or occasionally consciously. It's like, I just don't want to talk about it, and I don't have time for this, blah, blah, blah. But it was a real interesting moment to consider. I was trying to imagine what it was like to be a horse. It's like, why would I be behaving in that manner if I was a horse? And it was like, oh, I would feel less safe because I was unsure what was happening. Like, oh my gosh, my partner is feeling less safety because she's unsure of what's happening, rather than me just saying, I'm angry right now, pissed off. I'm like, I don't want to talk. Thoughts on that as an expert therapist / human being?
It's interesting. I don't know horses well enough to say this, but my experience of them so far has been that they don't energetically leave. You know, they might do something different, but they energetically don't leave. Humans do some weird stuff where we can like energetically leave. Not quite sure what that's about. But you know, the idea is that we're doing something energetically so we don't have to be in contact. And I think that's the wisdom of the horse to me. I mean, I sound a little grandiose there, but like,
we got butterfly wisdom, we got horse wisdom.
Do you know how to live in contact all the time? Can you try to be? Can you not accept the ways that you break contact and other people break contact with you? Can you insist on it in yourself? And also, like, I don't know, maybe that sounds a little demanding, but that's okay too. But to really know that the contactful way of life is more rich and connected and has the best chance of fulfilling us. And so our job is to try to get back there. And it's hard. It's really hard.
You said this great line that I wrote down that I wanted to maybe drop here, because it's about this idea of control.
Sure.
You said control is what we do when we don't trust. And I feel like contact and control have a pretty close dynamic relationship.
Yeah.
Whereby maybe you could expand on that a bit.
This is passing on again the wisdom of teacher Dewey Freeman here. So Dewey has this definition of relationship that is profound. And he says it's the ability to influence. Contact is the ability to influence and be influenced in relationship. And it's also the place where our physical, emotional, energetic, spiritual boundaries might touch. So it's like a meeting place. So relationship is the ability to influence and be influenced. And the way that he breaks that down, the way that relationship breaks, is he talks about the difference between power and control in that regard. And like with anything, power and control, they're tricky words. You know, they mean such different things to different people. So in this paradigm, we infuse them with particular meaning. So just, you kind of have to take on the meaning specific to Gestalt and these things to get this. But power is the ability to influence and be influenced. It's what it is. It's not just influencing, it's being influenced. Really letting who, what, everything you're with influence you. It's like a way of staying connected to yourself and the other at all times. Control is different. Control is what people do when they don't trust. And so again, this is Dewey's stuff. And if you just think about it, that's real quick. When trust is broken, we start getting controlling. You know, people manipulate. You know, there's acts of omission and commission. We withdraw entirely our energy to control. Not put you on the spot, but like, you know, if you're withdrawing in that situation, you can't be felt. There's a way that's like, I'm not trusting something here, and I'm going to be less influenced or try to influence less. And I'm just going to be in my own zone. And that's how I'm going to maintain some control. And it bleeds over a little bit into Dewey's developmental model. But that's the main piece. It's like, do you know how to be influenced and to influence, like with skill, and stay in contact?
It's such an interesting consideration that being powerful means that you are able to be influenced.
Ooh.
Like that's a paradigm shifter for me. As you said that, I'm like, hang on, what? So maybe can you say a bit more on that? Like what?
If you don't let yourself be influenced, no one's going to trust you. If you don't let yourself be influenced, no one's going to be able to feel you. There's not relationship there. Why would you trust? Why would you be open, share space with someone who doesn't feel you and isn't responsive to you as a being? I can see extreme situations where, like in war or something like that, where that might be appropriate or something. But for the most part, for most how most of us live, it's an awful experience to not be able to influence another.
Mm.
Like, so how many of the relationship difficulties you've experienced are like, my pain doesn't matter to you. My experience doesn't matter to you. You won't let yourself be influenced by my experience. If you won't let be influenced by my experience, then I'm going to pull away and I'm not going to be influenced by your experience. Or I'm going to punish you for not being influenced by my experience. I'm going to like use a bigger hammer, you know?
Right. I talk about this idea that kind hearts are strong hearts.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, in just thinking this through now, that compassion and empathy require a unique form of power, which by your definition is to be influenced by the other or those around us. And I'm just kind of realizing perhaps that's why it seems like there is a lack of empathy and connection in this planet. It's because we perceive power in a way that is perverse to what it truly might be. Is that fair?
It is fair. I mean, let's also give some appreciation to, there is a part of life. So a lot of my world is in men's work. If you look at a lot of the masculine archetypes, warrior archetype, for example, is so much about not being influenced. Like, can you hold steadfast to this goal, to this task? Can you be unwavering? Nothing pulls you off of it. You know, not your emotions, not hardship. Like, so I think it's very hard for us because there are certain human things that it's right to not be influenced. But when those ways of being become really ingrained in people who embody the archetype all the way, it's problematic. I also work with a lot of vets and first responders, and their whole life was learning to not be influenced so they could do their job well. And but then their family lives are a wreck. You know, they're deep in addiction. So there are certain things in life that actually require us to be less influenced. And it's just part of the dance to like return to how to really do it. Like that shouldn't be a way of life, hopefully. I mean, but.
For this idea of stoicism and being a stoic, I feel is another example of that. Just, I'm the mountain and everything else washes over me. And you kind of, on one level, I suppose I do understand that. Uh-huh. And it is perhaps at a certain level, productive, essential, useful. But if it's too much, then it's like, you're a robot. You're not fully, truly alive.
Yeah.
Right?
100%. I think that there's always these big pendulum swings to try to figure out how to deal with the chaotic nature of life. Like stoicism makes a lot of sense in that, like, but there's so much consequence. It prunes away so much of what makes us human just for the sake of stability. So there's like a huge sacrifice. There's a trade-off there. We're always making these weird deals with the energies in life. I will sacrifice all of these parts of being human for being really grounded. And that being grounded will protect certain parts of being human, and I won't wreck it. And so I do think I'm a little suspicious of the ones that don't allow us to be influenced, spiritual traditions that don't allow the energy of life to really hit us and impact us.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah. You have this other good line on your website. Your website's great, man. It has a couple gems on there. It's like, oh, I've never heard that quote before. Wow. I need to sit with that. He said, let's not forget to keep our centers in the realms of the ineffable.
Yeah.
That is a Michael Gay original, I believe. It wasn't even you quoting
yeah.
Robert Bly or one of the greats. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Man, that's good. So what does that mean to you to keep our centers in the realms of the ineffable?
It's what we were talking about earlier, that energetic inside place, the ineffable, for those of you not, just means you can't really put it into words. But the most important and powerful and beautiful parts of life are a felt experience, connection to the eternal, connection to forces bigger than us, transpersonal pieces. And connecting, you know, Joseph Campbell, I believe he's quoting someone else, like Durkheim or something, but he says the greatest stories can't be told, the second best are misunderstood, and the third are our, kind of like our biographies. And he also talks about how we have to use myth to point at these truths. We have to use these like cryptic tools to point at the things in life that really matter, because they will not allow themselves to be grabbed by words. You use words and other things to put people in contact with the ineffable, and that you're not having like a full, really dynamic human experience, not quite at your center yet, unless it's coming from an ineffable place. So in a time period that's obsessed with like saying it well and creatively and nailing it down in the logos, there's like a little return inside. It all has to be coming from mythos. It all has to be coming from our deeply human, deeply original human center.
We touched on that a little bit before we started recording about the men's work that you do and the mm-hmm. initiation that Traver runs and how it's experiential, right? Yeah. It's like you can't make a sales page that adequately describes what occurs there. You have to, you know, like a visit to the Grand Canyon or any spectacular place that's powerful and awe-inspiring. It's like you just have to be there and you have to feel it and you have to see it. Mm-hmm. You have to be part of it. And I think to your point, that also is an adequate description of life as well, love or relationship or doing the work or having a breakthrough, et cetera. It just seems like the ineffable is actually where the real juice is, so to speak.
Absolutely.
It's like that's what we're all kind of chasing.
Yeah.
Those feelings. Perhaps we can spend a bit of time talking about dudes.
Great.
Men.
Let's talk dudes.
Let's talk some dude talk, you know? Because I know that that's a big part of your life. You you work with men, do men's work.
Yeah.
You are passionate about those ideas. Mm-hmm. What's going on with men, Michael? What's the deal? Seems like there's some stuff happening that
might be
we should pay attention to.
Yeah.
Try to resolve.
Could be the case.
I mean, I know that's a gigantic softball question, opening a can of worms in the Pandora's box, and we could have a whole separate conversation about that. But any insights?
I think somewhere along the way, I do think that what we're always looking for is a certain kind of like ineffable organizing principle, like a certain place that trickles into our identities and makes us better, more rich human beings. And somewhere, I don't know, through Western civilization or industrialization, men really lost some kind of really sacred organizing principle in the masculine soul. Like we lost touch with it. I think there you know, it does come through in certain places, but we're talking numbers and averages, we lost touch with it somewhere. And so the work that I'm passionate about is finding it again and waking it up again. What's that thing that puts us into accord with each other and with life? Joseph Campbell uses those words all the time. Like, what is it that puts us into accord with the greater forces that be and with ourselves? And there's just some type of, who knows why that happened? You know, is it a sickness? Is it like a spiritual disease? Is it a disease of consciousness? Is it a product of industrialization? Is it, there's all different kinds of ways to understand it. But if, before we like get solution focused, like, can we just say we lost connection to something that puts us into accord with, and if we were in accord with it, things would be a whole lot better. And we'd probably feel more connected, a bit more wise, a bit less destructive, a bit more available for contact, to be influenced, to be really alive, to be creative. And so, yeah. So we got to hang in that for a minute. You get to, like, this is part of it, is like learning how to just hang out in the space of being troubled by that kind of like a question. Like, is it your listener out there? Can the people that are listening, can they feel that viscerally inside them? Yeah, somewhere, masculine soul. It's not a criticism. I do believe there's some kind of innocence in it. Despite all the violence that's been perpetrated, like, I think the violence is more of a result of the loss, symptom of the loss. And that totally needs to be addressed. And addressing that symptom might be a big part of the path to get back to what wholeness looks like the grief and the listening and the witnessing and reconciliation work. That's a dark place in the forest that we could probably all enter, that might take us a little bit closer to the grail. But yeah, can we just feel what it's like to have that principle missing? Can you feel it? Can you feel what's happened to the land without that organizing principle? And all these old stories, you know, when the like one royal person, the king or queen, is sick, the land becomes sick. Like, who gives a fuck about old school royal structural society? It's just a metaphor for energy. There's like a really royal organizing principle in us, and it's kind of sick. And the land has gone into a dark place. It's asleep. There's a lot of chaos. There's war, there's decay, there's confusion. And we're probably all do well to be on this kind of quest, but because it's a big part of my life, you know, men need to really be on that. And women need to have an attunement to what it means for men to be on that path to like reclaim that organizing principle, that accord, if it helps you call it a king place.
In your own life, personally, what does that look like? Like this idea of being a better man or being the best Michael Gay possible? Or is it more like a feeling or a knowing?
It's a feeling and a knowing I'm trying to pursue in myself. It's like, I want to try to have that. I want to have a rapturous experience, which often comes through looking at the ways that I've not shown up well, or I've really fucked up, or hurt people, or unconsciously, or I want to feel the consequence in me, and like the longing and the sadness and the anger and the confusion of not having, and I want to know anytime I feel that stuff, that's a cue for me to look for that compass bearing inside me. I don't want to be taken off by the waves so much. So what it looks like is, it's a way of life. You know, I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm not. It's way easier to say this stuff, you know, to say the principles and the values. It's way easier to say it than it is to live it. It's always messier to live it. But we have the values, to their aspirations, their aims. And so for me, the big thing that's made the biggest difference is surrounding myself with people who carry some of that energy, and teachers and friends. And like when I formed a men's group a couple of years ago when I was living in Boulder, and I hardly knew any of the people I invited. They're just men in the community that had been around. And I was like, they have something. Like I feel something when I'm in the presence. Like I kind of know they're interested in, you know, myth or herbalism or whatever it may be. But it was like a felt sense. Like, I think they carry some of the same burning as I do. What happens if we get together we put our fires together. Oh shit, it burns like way brighter. We're a lot warmer. Get a lot more done. We become much better when we like put our fires together for a while. And I'm way brighter when I leave and go out in the world and do my thing. So people choice is a huge thing. I like to read. So books, places. Like I'm in Maui right now. And part of the reason I came here is because the land is dripping with aliveness. There's green on top of green on top of green and whales in a circle around the island, and can't go anywhere without that energy going into my body. And so it's like a bathing. I gotta like bathe myself in these people and in these places. Like a ritual washing, like scrubbing off the road dust.
I love that. It's such a powerful visual too. You were living in Colorado, right? And
then
I can't recall, but my recollection is that you had a dream or just had this knowing that I need to go to Hawaii.
Yeah,
like totally. You told me that?
Yeah. I mean, the nutshell elevator speech version is at one of my, when I followed one of those spiritual or like deep inner things, got involved with a teacher I shouldn't have been involved with, who's kind of shadowy, like really broke me. And I like went to the desert. I'm like, biblical imprint. All right, 40 days in the desert, you know, and like packed my truck full of food and water, went outside of Moab and hung out for 40 days in 2010 and just like prayed and read and walked in the canyons. And when I did that, it gave a space for this something in me, my center spot, to wake up a little bit more and build some momentum. And I just started having dreams from then on that guide my life. Every couple of years, one of them comes and I follow it. And the last dream was about coming here. And yeah, so I made big leaps. I like sold a house. I left all of those great friends. And but it's because I have enough faith. I follow this stuff enough and it works out and life deepens and opens. Mm-hmm. And so I'm here trying to understand what it was a call in that dream. But I've lived it enough to where I come here and I've got no idea what the heck it's about. I know that this is the thing that I follow. So yeah, I dream from here.
Yeah.
And that's one of the places that place speaks to me, is through dream.
Mm. Like tapping into that subconscious kind of language or mysticism.
Subconscious, yes. But like transpersonal, like the beyond.
All right.
Michael Gay world. Like I really believe the dream world goes far beyond my life and awareness and consciousness and subconscious. Like it's plugged into a much bigger thing.
This is perhaps a rabbit hole, and I love that. You're talking here about like a universal consciousness, or like what life actually is, or where we fit in the cosmos kind of deal.
I'm at the point in life where I'd probably like, you know, shake all of those terms off. Like, okay. No, not quite, but like, the holiest parts of life. I think the place where the things that really matter might come from can come from that place. Things worthwhile, the things that like help us a lot that we really need can come from that place that we plug into in dreams. And we can work to get that path a little more well-traveled so it flows better. Some people just have a gift. Some people have to kind of wake it up. Yeah.
A gift to acknowledge that source or whatever you want to call it.
Some people are just good dreamers. Some people like that's literally, I'm just tangibly at night, they have dreams. Something comes in that's very guiding and powerful and transpersonal. It's just like a place that the cosmos speaks really loudly. Some people, and I just think it's a gift. It's like people being a great musician. Like some people just can play and get it. Some people are born with this talent for dreaming and the rest of us have to practice.
Yeah, like I had a dream the other night that I was eating a donut. You know, it's like doesn't seem like that's sure. the same level that you're describing.
It may not be. It may not be.
Yeah.
I have a lot of dreams like that too. But yeah. I try to live in a way where those big ones will like wash through on the tide.
Yeah.
You know, it's like fishing. Like a lot of times I go fishing and I don't catch anything. It's just sometimes random shit happens.
Yeah, like one version for me is meditation. I feel like occasionally I drop real deep and I can picture myself just falling through this darkness. And I picture it like like the ocean, I suppose, where at the top it's really bright and there's vibrant, yeah, colorful fish. And then you get a little, mm-hmm, deeper and deeper. It's darker. It's, yeah, quieter. And then it's just like floating in nothingness. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally it'll be like, bing, some, yeah, profound insight or a phrase, or like, yeah, like I need to go to Maui, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like the act of cultivation of that is an aspirational idea, perhaps, to consider.
Yeah. Like that, for lack of a better word, it's like an instinct. Like, you know, it's like a smell you catch on the wind or like a feeling in the air. It's like, it's time to migrate now. Like, yeah, that stuff comes through. It's like an instinctive, primal part of the self that shines through more easily when we get really still or in a flow state. Or
you see this often in your therapeutic practice with clients where they say like, oh, I just really want to, you know, leave my partner, or I really want to start a business, or I'm feeling called to blah, blah, blah. Is this something that you see frequently, or is it rare, or how common are these calls, so to speak?
Well, I'm going to way oversimplify. I had a friend recently kind of turn me onto this way of thinking. But if you're looking as a listener for something practical to do and try, just there's a different way our mind navigates life, and there's a different way our heart navigates life. There's a different way our instinctual, gut, primal, intuitive self navigates life. So a lot of times when I'm working with people and they're thinking about having a breakup, I'm just like, hang out in the mind space. Like, only locate your awareness there for a minute. Feel into it, navigate, talk, whatever you need. From that place, explore it here. All right, drop down again. Do the same thing, but only from the heart space. Like, navigate the entire terrain only from the heart space. All right, now drop down to the gut. Can you navigate all of this just from that place? What happens? Now, can you start pairing them up? Can you do heart and gut at the same time? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see it all the time in people. Like that big forces just start to mobilize, these like tipping points. And I feel like that's, therapy sometimes feels like midwifery in that, or a lot of times, that there's this really big thing trying to come through. And my job is to just steward people and help them give birth to that new version of themselves or new orientation. And it just starts to flow and happen. And my job is to really help them get behind the energy and follow it through. Yeah, it happens all the time. People get these really deep knowings that they just have to act out. And I get the privilege of being a listener. So I get to hear a lot of people tell these stories of how it works out when they know how to connect to this place and they follow it. So it also inspires my faith. Like, wow, this shit really works. Like, and like, ooh, man, that was a big, they're bumbling on that one. They probably made a mistake. Like, they were following what they thought was guidance, but it was really just reactivity and ego. But this is how they learn. It was like a blend between like the wise place and the ego, and okay, they're learning. Can I help them learn a little bit?
I hear that pretty frequently myself, where I'll be talking to a client, mm-hmm, and I'll hear myself say something. And then there's a part of my brain that's like, really, really? Oh, they should do that. Like, do you hear yourself, bro? What about that, you know, yeah, thing that just happened? And so as you said earlier, it's one thing to know, and it's another to actually embody or accept or embrace or choose to act on that knowledge, right?
Yeah.
What have we not talked about? Is there anything that's jumped out? I mean, we talked about butterflies, we talked about universal consciousness, we talked about men. Talk about energetics, talk about horses. Is there anything that you're feeling called or passionate about where you're like, no, Jeremy, man, like, I gotta say this thing, or I need the world to know this?
I can't pass up any opportunity to not put in a little bit of a plug for Dewey's developmental model, because I think it's like a missing key. So can I give an elevator speech real quick?
Yeah. Can I introduce it though?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So Dewey Freeman is he's teaching this workshop in Colorado with a bunch of dudes, and we're all there. And I can't remember, maybe it was over lunch or at the beginning of one of his talks. And he talks about this idea of like, and he's gruff and he's like a cowboy and he's an older guy, just so you can picture him. And he's like, you know, Freud and Jung, they all just made shit up. I can make shit up too. Besides, I've had a lot more client hours than they ever did.
That's right.
And I love that perspective. Like, I've never considered that Freud and all the big shots just like made shit up. And so then he also made some shit up based upon his 50 years working with people and living. And then he has this developmental model that you perhaps can summarize.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I think that's the piece, like, you know, all those guys, they made shit up. They connected to a living wisdom inside themselves, and Dewey did that. And the piece I love about Dewey, you know, horses have really been his teachers. That informs just about everything now. But developmentally, I'm not going to give you the full breakdown, but it's an understanding of how the self is formed over time at different stages in life. Like, what are there real central questions that we're answering at certain ages on a deep level? And they really help us as therapists and clinicians because they help us locate where people are energetically. The first several stages of life are energetic stages, like they're without language. Like, a kid is a purely energetic being. And us as people and parents, like, they're experiencing us as energy, not as like words or concepts. And so some of the real basic energetic foundations that are being laid early on in life are, you know, can I exist? Do I exist? Is the world okay? Am I okay? How much can I do? How well can I do it? And these are the stages that Dewey lays out in his model. But the piece that I like talking about with people is that the first three stages, prenatal, and then the first three and a half years of life are is the world okay? Am I okay? Those are nonverbal, non-cognitive stages of life. So is the world okay is an energetic experience. Am I okay is an energetic experience. And so often people come to personal growth work or therapy work because something about the world doesn't feel okay. And something about like themselves just doesn't feel okay. And anytime intense trauma happens or hard things happen, we kind of go back through these questions again. We lose someone. You know, is the world okay without this person? Am I okay without this person? How much can I do without this person? And so I think I want to just say that if you're in this world of development and personal healing, make sure you're spending a lot of time in those nonverbal, non-cognitive dimensions. Because if you don't, you're going to miss out on the foundations of everything. We know from trauma research that the really deep parts of the nervous system and the brain that hold the trauma aren't accessed by language. And so we have to use these approaches that get us into that zone. So language is a good jumping off point. It can assist, it can help. It's very important at some point. And if we're not doing the things that get us beyond language, into feeling, into embodiment, into the transpersonal, then it's always going to be building the castle on some shifting sands.
Well said. And just to clarify that idea of pre-verbal, pre-language, if you think of like a six-month-old that doesn't know how to communicate other than screaming, crying, moaning, etc., but experiences something in the world that's going to be stored in the body and in the mind in a way that is not just a thought, right? It's what my understanding of how trauma is stored in the body. It's like something happens and it just is like put in there, stored away, locked away. And because it's not a consequence of language or an adult, it's indescribable, right? It can't be accessed. Is that a fair?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect.
All right, man. Well, it's been about 65 minutes.
Great. It's been an honor, man.
You're wonderful. And I just so appreciate you. Where can people find you? I know you've got a website that I'll put in the show notes.
Sure. Yeah, I have. I'm not a big internet active person. So
yeah,
if people want a glimpse, there's other podcasts and stuff on my website. And there's
you're like a very, elusive guy. I feel like it'd be like, oh man, I saw Michael Gay out in the wild. You're like, really? What was he doing? Like, you know, you're not on the socials. You're not on the Twitter. Yeah.
No. I do have an Instagram handle, LightningTreeMG, but that's that's its own thing. Maybe one day I'll like be on there a little bit more. But if you want to be in touch, we're going to start rolling out some of these men's weekends. We've got one coming up in Austin, Texas in April, Colorado in August, and then on the East Coast in October. And it's very likely that we'll be rolling out some more work with horses and energetic pieces in the coming years. So stay tuned.
Yeah. And as somebody that has been to those and has experienced them and has seen you work for several days firsthand, if you're listening, I strongly encourage you to consider going. Or if you know somebody that might benefit from that, send them the website, drop the hint, plant the seed. It is it's very transformative, powerful medicine that you are creating with your pals and partners in crime. And I think it's the medicine the world needs. I've said it, it's on the video. Like I'm on the promo video saying it. So I'm stoked to know you. I'm stoked to be able to spread the gospel that you are preaching, so to speak. And thanks for being you, man.
Likewise, man. Thank you so much for the invitation, for the meander together.
Yeah, it was a wild one, hey?
All right, so that's Michael Gay. I warned you in the intro that he is deep and profound and wise, and I hope you agree with me now that he is indeed all of those things. As mentioned, he's not very internet prolific, but you can find him, you can work with him directly one-on-one, and you can also attend some of these gatherings that he and Dewey and Traver lead, of which I strongly support and encourage you to get to if you are a dude who is looking for some answers, if you are tired of going alone and feeling uncomfortable. Try it. It's powerful medicine. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Thanks for all the 5-star reviews. It does help. It does make my life more meaningful when I read the comments that make me smile. So thank you for sharing and supporting. I adore you. You make my life better. And I thank you for that.